to the hashtag STR Ask podcast. Welcome, everyone. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kokel is here with me to answer your questions from Twitter.
Morning, Amy.
Good morning, Greg. So, Greg, last time, in the last episode, we talked a lot about the law and the end of the law and when the end of the law happened.
Mm-hmm.
And we never got to the next question, which is somewhat related. So this is kind of a continuation from the last episode. But here's a question from Choose, but Choose Wisely. What do you make of Jesus' exchange with the Canaanite woman in Matthew 15?
Mm.
He ignores her request to heal her daughter, says he's only sent to lost Jews, and refers to non-Jews as dogs in verses 23 through 26.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually heals, but his prior responses don't show a gentle Jesus shown elsewhere.
Right. This is a very interesting passage, and I do think it's enigmatic. Let me put it this way. For me, until I heard Don Richardson, the kind of well-known missionary and missionary writer, give his take on this. And it makes absolute and complete sense once I heard the whole take. It makes sense of everything. But I had never heard anybody make this comment before. Okay. And so I'm at Matthew 15 right now. And let's see, I have to turn to the passage proper. The Syrophoenician woman. Okay, so now in Jesus' ministry, he has a great public acclaim in the beginning. He's really, really popular. Although he ran into a little trouble, you know, in his own town, Nazareth, at the synagogue there, early on, he still, I think it's Matthew or Luke 5 or whatever it is, he still was just for the most part really well received. And then halfway through his ministry, there was a turn, and this was after he had fed the 5,000. And John chapter 6 marks in that gospel the transition, and that's when his disciples left him in mass because they didn't like what he had to say. This was the eat my flesh, drink my blood passage. And which, by the way, he was not at all referring to the Lord's Supper there, as the Roman Catholics take it. He couldn't have been, because no one would have understood what he was talking about. But he was making a point apropos to the circumstances. In any event, what happened in the second half of his ministry then, as he moved towards the Passion Week, is he spent more time alone with his disciples in outlying areas, discipling them to carry on after him, and he spoke more of his imminent death. And this is why he's way up north in Syrophoenicia, having this encounter with the Syrophoenician woman whose daughter is demon-possessed, okay? Now, she pleads with him for help, and oddly, he doesn't initially offer help but seems to shun her. It's odd because in all the other passages, we see Jesus moved with compassion. And that she's Syrophoenician is irrelevant to this point. In other words, she's not Jewish, even with what Jesus says. And I'll explain that in a moment. And this insight is completely from Don Richardson. But notice that even the fact that she's Syrophoenician is irrelevant because Jesus reached out to many Gentiles and mm-hmm. applauded them. Think of the centurion, you know. You don't need to come under my roof. Just speak the words and my servant will be healed. He says, such faith I haven't seen in all of Israel, you know. So there are quite a number of times where you see Jesus gladly reaching out to the Gentiles, partly because that's been the point all along. My house is a house of prayer to all nations. Remember, Jesus says that when he cleanses the temple. And that goes all the way back to the dedication of the temple by Solomon. And so what the heck is going on here then? And by the way, if you don't read this rightly, you have a severe contradiction. Because Jesus says after she asked him for help, he said, it is not good to give the children's bread to dogs. Now the children are the Jews, and the bread of the children is the Messiah. That seems pretty straightforward. The dogs are the Gentiles. It was a common term that was used pejoratively of non-Jews by Jews, okay? So, but just a few moments later, he gives the bread to the dog, though he says it's not good to do that. So if he means it's not good to do that, and then he does it, then he's doing something that by his own admission is not good. So what's going on here? And here's what Don Richardson said. Don Richardson said what Jesus reflects here is pretty obviously not his theology, because he hasn't been acting like this so far. Don Richardson says this is the theology of the religious aristocracy of the land. And what he's doing is repeating the religious line of the Jews regarding the Gentiles. And we're not going to give our good stuff to you dogs. Forget about that. And what does the woman say? She says something very insightful and very clever. She said, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the table. She knows that the Jew, he's up here in Syrophoenicia because he's not being well received anymore down then. He's got a lot of conflict with the Jews. She must know something about who he is. And this is why she comes to him for help. And she realizes, yeah, they're rejecting you. Just like John says in John chapter 1, he came to his own and his own did not receive him, but to as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. So here's one of the other many that's not his own that is opening to receive Jesus. You know, I don't mean to ask into his life, please be my Savior. That's the way we use the term nowadays. But to receive that one, to say, okay, I'm here. I'm taking you. I'm taking you for who you claim to be. I'm not rejecting you. And so then he commends her for her clever response, which reflects her faith. And then he does the very thing that he previously said is not good to do, because that's not his theology. It's aberrant theology of the Jews at the time, and his actions are meant to refute the theology he has just parroted, the theology of the Jewish leaders.
So, yeah, I think it was aberrant in the sense that maybe they would be calling people dogs and that sort of thing. But obviously, yes, it really was true that the Gentiles were separated from God and that the covenant was with the Jews. And she recognized that. She recognized who he was. And I just wanted to, one thing I came across just recently when I kind of made a connection between this and the story of the centurion that you mentioned, Greg, that story's in chapter 8. And what he says, because the centurion comes to him and says, please heal my servant. And then Jesus starts to go and he says, no, I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. You can just say, go.
Say the word.
You can say the word and he'll be healed.
Yes, so, I'm a man who is in authority myself. And I tell my soldiers, do this, do that, they do it. I understand how authority works. Yeah.
So he's expressing way more faith than the Pharisees that you were just talking about that
right.
Jesus was demonstrating to in the other story. But here's what Jesus says, and this is interesting. Truly I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So here we have this same imagery of the table where Jesus is saying, the Gentiles will come and eat at the table, and those who thought that they would be there will not be there.
Right.
And so later on, when we come to the Canaanite woman, she uses the same imagery of,
right,
you know,
at the table.
She eats the crumbs from the table. He's actually saying earlier on, you will come and sit at the table. So we know,
right,
this speaks to what you were saying about Jesus' theology, mm-hmm, Greg. We know that, yeah, from chapter 8, he was saying the Gentiles would come and feast at the table, not just eat the crumbs underneath, mm-hmm, which is what maybe the Pharisees thought. And honestly,
or maybe she was willing to settle for, if they're tossing,
right,
the crumbs away, then I'll take what's left over, you know.
Right. And here Jesus is saying, no, you can come and you
yeah,
can
that's great.
Feast with me. And it's not necessarily animus that any particular Jew would think that these Gentiles wouldn't be able to feast with them, because so far, and well, I'll come back around to this, but so far the law has separated the Jews
right.
from the Gentile.
This is what you were talking about Ephesians 2 in our last conversation, right?
Right. However, they should have known from way back with the covenant with Abraham that was by
right.
faith that God said he would make him a father of many nations.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other parts that talk about how the Gentiles will come. And that might even mention the table also. I wish I had thought to look that one up. Hmm. But the Gentiles, there are other parts in the Old Testament that talk about the Gentiles coming in. So that he was going to be a blessing to all nations.
Actually, the prophets are thick with these kinds of references about the Gentiles coming and worshiping the God of Israel. And I mentioned last time that when the temple was dedicated, Solomon prayed the temple will be a place of prayer for all the nations. And then Jesus cites that when he cleanses the temple, because the it has been being abused, and the Gentiles that were coming then were being taken advantage of. And so, this theme that all the nations, this goes back to the beginning. This is something that Don Richardson was pointing out. And by the way, I mentioned that Jesus had a lot of public favor, except for he had that little trouble in Nazareth, you know, in the early parts of the Gospels, where he said, today this verse has been fulfilled in your hearing. And when every movie I've seen that depicts that dramatic scene has people getting angry at Jesus when he says this verse is fulfilled, as if they think it's awful that he is claiming to be the Messiah. That isn't the way the text reads. What happens is people think he's wonderful when he says that, but then he talks about Naaman, you know, and another Gentile from the Old Testament, and how God favored them. And then the text says, when he said this, they became furious and they drove him to the edge of the cliff to kill them. This was how strong their bias towards Gentiles and their animosity towards Gentiles was. So this is a thing that Jesus is dealing with in his entire ministry, the built-in animosity towards the Gentiles. By the way, it's understandable considering what had happened for the last 400 years in the history of Jews since Malachi, the last prophet. They were terribly mistreated by especially the Greeks when they held sway of that area. And you have Antiochus Epiphanes sacrificing a pig on the altar, and you have a big Maccabean revolt. And so this really kind of where they had been willing to go along with the Gentiles for 1,000 years, they're hanging out and doing all the things and worshiping their gods and intermarrying with their people. And this was a huge problem. Now they're already on the other side of the spectrum. And now they're rigidly anti-Gentile and very prejudiced in that regard. And this is what now Jesus has to deal with.
And it's such a human thing, that the pendulum back and forth, because of course, the reason why they went into exile was because they were ignoring the law.
Right.
So they come back. We don't want that to happen again.
Right.
So
right.
now we're going to follow it very closely. And
hate the people on the outside.
Yeah.
And that's what ended up happening.
And it's not surprising that they would assume that even if God were to bring in Gentiles, he would do it through the law, under the law. But of course, as Paul says in Galatians, the law came after Abraham. Abraham was justified by faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the law came as in order to reveal our sin to us and lead us to Christ, where we would have our righteousness by faith.
Right.
This is what it says in Galatians. And then Romans 4 also says that the whole reason why it is by faith is so that it can be promised to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's by law, we will never be able to measure up. But if it's by faith, then it's God who is the one who's doing the saving.
Right.
And giving us the righteousness of Christ, and therefore he can bring it about. So
this is the unique feature of the Christian worldview, is in Christianity, man does not rescue himself. God rescues him because man cannot rescue himself. And every other religious group, including quasi-Christian groups like the LDS and like the Jehovah's Witnesses and others, salvation is always grounded in human behavior.
Mm-hmm. So here is another question. And actually, we've touched on it a little bit, I think, already. But this one comes from EMK. Is faith a work? Why does it seem like people in the Old Testament, and then she has parentheses, Abraham, are credited for their belief?
Well, faith can't be a work simply because faith is contrasted with works in the New Testament. So if faith is an act of human beings and it entails some a kind of effort, you make a decision to put your trust in, I can see how some people would construe that as a work, but that is exactly what we are asked to do. We are to put our trust in Christ, and that is called an act of faith. And James says, faith without works is dead. All right. Now, apart from the theology of that point, notice that faith and works aren't the same thing. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, okay? But the faith, that's in Hebrews, you know. Actually, there's no contrast there between faith and works. There's a number of different passages. If righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died needlessly, okay? There's a whole bunch of passages that contrast the concept of faith with works. By grace you are saved through faith. It's not of yourselves. It's a gift of God, not of works that anyone should boast. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. First verse I ever memorized, by the way. And I didn't try. It just stuck because it's such a powerful and significant passage. So notice that he says, well, I mean, strictly speaking, it's not faith that saves us. It's God's grace that saves us. And faith is the only thing that we do to initiate the grace that rescues us. But the faith in that is not construed as a work. It's contrasted with works, okay? And so we have people acting in faith in the Old Testament, and we have behaviors that demonstrate their faith. And this actually goes back to the James passage, because James is talking about a genuine faith that manifests itself in behavior. It isn't the behavior that saves, it is the faith that saves, but it's not a real faith, a true, legitimate faith, unless it makes a difference in your life. You are not measured by your works, you are measured by your faith, but the works demonstrate that there is a real faith there. That's James's point, and we see that played out with the saints in the Old Testament. They didn't keep the law perfectly, obviously, but they were trusting in God through the means that God had given to express their trust. And that's a big part of what the Old Testament sacrificial system is. The blood of bulls and goats can never take away sin. This is stated explicitly in the book of Hebrews. But what it does is it's an act of faith that, in obedience to what God is telling them to do, they realize this is the way that God is going to justify them at the moment. And so they act out of trust by obeying the provision, okay? It isn't the provision that saves them. It's their trust that does. And this starts in Abraham, and this is why the archetype of the saved person is always Abraham. The text in the New Testament always goes back to Abraham when it makes these claims that salvation is by our faith, mm-hmm. not by our works.
I recommend Romans 4 just goes through all of this because EMK asks, you know, why does it seem like people in the Old Testament are credited for their belief? And this is the question that Romans 4 answers. So what then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, has found? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. So then it goes on, and I could read the whole thing as an answer to this question, but I'll try and summarize. And he says that the promise to Abraham I will read this part. For the promise to Abraham or to his descendants that he would be heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void and the promise is nullified. For the law brings about wrath. But where there is no law, there also is no violation. And then he says, this is why it is by faith. Because if it's by law, we will fail.
Yeah.
But if it's not by law, if it's by grace, then God can guarantee it because it depends on God.
You know, I appreciate the hyperbolic statement in that chapter where he goes overboard almost. For him who works, it is reckoned as what is due. But for him who does not work, but believes in a God who justifies the unrighteous, to him it is reckoned as righteousness. I mean, it's somewhat hyperbolic, but it's really an accurate, almost literal point. It sounds hyperbolic. It sounds like he's exaggerating, does not work. But I think this is what he actually means. It's not the working. The working is unrelated to that. Now, he doesn't advocate people don't work and live righteously. And he corrects this error in the beginning of chapter 6 of Romans. But it's interesting that he has to address in chapter 6 the mistaken notion that people think he's teaching license. Okay? And a number of people have observed that if you are not teaching grace in a way that could be mistaken for license, then you are not teaching grace the way Paul taught it. Because his teaching could be, and he needed to correct that. So Romans 4 and 5 leads to the clarification in Romans 6. Shall we sin that grace should increase? Of course not, you idiots! That's not what's going on here. If you're freed from sin, then you're a slave to Christ, not to sin. So why are you going to live as a slave to that which you've been freed from? That's his point. The new birth really secures that.
He says we died. If we died to sin and were raised with Christ, don't offer the members of your body to sin. We're new creatures now. We have a new goal in life. We have the freedom of having the Spirit. But the point of all of this is that faith goes all the way back to Abraham. It's not as if it was by law at one time and now it's by faith. It was always by faith. The law came in for other purposes other than salvation.
Mm-hmm.
That was always by God's grace. And in Romans 9, at the end of Romans 9, Paul says he says, so what should we say? The Gentiles were not pursuing righteousness, but now they've achieved righteousness by faith. And then he says, but Israel, pursuing a law of righteousness, did not arrive at that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as though it were by works. So they missed the point of Abraham, that all of this was that salvation and reconciliation with God would be by faith, not by following the law. So they missed that. And so now the question is, she says, why does it seem like this is happening? And when you think about the definition of faith in Hebrews, it says, no one can please God without faith, because he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he rewards those who seek him. So when you have faith, you are trusting in God, you are trusting in his word, you are giving him glory with your faith. And in the end, our salvation is about God's glory. So that is why ultimately it's by faith. So God can give us the grace and he will be glorified. That's the goal of all of creation. So that is why it's always been by faith that people come to God.
Nicely put, Amy, as usual. And here we did another show on the grace of God. And the relationship to the law. which is a topic
I
can
go
you
on
can't.
And on about this.
I know this is a topic that cannot be exhausted, and I just autobiographically, it is the message of the grace of God that has transformed my life from my beginning as a Christian and has made all the difference. I have never had this kind of existential awareness that I am not keeping up. I mean, I've had that awareness, but that somehow has jeopardized my security in Christ. Because very early on, through probably a variety of circumstances, I became acquainted richly with the grace of God, and it became the foundation of my own salvation. I was raised Roman Catholic, and so I think I knew the law. This is in a Vatican I tradition, not a Vatican II tradition. By the time of Vatican II, I was gone from the Roman Catholic Church, mid-60s. But I understood the law. I didn't understand grace. And when I understood grace, this was transforming for me.
Well, thank you, Greg. And hopefully it will be transforming to others mm-hmm. as well. And to learn more about God's grace, I recommend reading the New Testament.
Let me offer a verse I've talked about before, and this is really one that drives it home. If you're ever worried that you are going to be out of God's favor as a Christian under Christ because you're sinning too much, okay? And then when I say favor, I mean salvific favor. All right. I mean, God doesn't like it when we sin and we get chastised. All right. But go back to the Psalm 130. And there the psalmist says, around verse 4 or 5, he said, "Lord, if you should mark iniquity, O Lord, who could stand? But there is forgiveness in you that you might be praised." And I think of that frequently. I want it on my tombstone because the point there is, if anybody is measured by their own efforts, no matter how good they are, if that is the criterion, everybody fails. Everybody fails. If you should mark iniquity, who could stand? And that encourages me. And that allows me then to embrace the grace of God, then seek the grace to live the way I ought to live in light of my salvation.
And note, that is the Old Testament. It's not a brand new idea that we need faith in God for our forgiveness.
That's right.
All right, Greg. Thank you.
Good show, Amy.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.